the arrogance of your heart misleads you. You live in a cave, high up on a cliff, killing time, asking in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? You live in a cave, high up on a cliff, killing time, asking in your heart, who will bring me down to earth? The arrogance of your heart misleads you. Obadiah 1:3, chapter 1, verse 3. The Word Green Version of 2003. Our daily scripture for today, little children, and our study for today is, once again, the Ark of Urartu, chapter 10, which is in part 2 of the Ark of Urartu, chapter 10, paragraph 7 today. Just trying to remember where part 2 began. Chapter 8 it began with? Or 7. Okay, it began with chapter 7, was the beginning of part 2. And here we are. Chapter 10, paragraph 7 today. Now, at the left, there's a map here. The left side of this page. And it's showing the distribution of the Arabic language, which is found in northern Africa and eastern Africa on the extreme eastern coast, and in Arabia, and in Palestine and Syria and Iraq, all of those places, in Jordan, all the places in the Levant region, which is south of Turkey. I'm sure there probably are some Arabic people also living in Turkey and in Iran, but it's predominantly these countries shown here, which are beginning on the west northern coast of Africa, going up. I think one of those countries, well, I'm not going to guess, I shouldn't guess what they are because I might get it wrong, but all the way across the north of Africa, and even in the central part, a couple of countries in the northern, but not the very northernmost part of Africa, in sort of in the middle of the continent, almost certainly that's where the Sahara Desert is located. But the colors there show that the dominant language, in the case of the blue color, is Arabic, and in the case of the green color, Arabic is the second language, and the countries with the green color are the one in the central most African country that is shaded, which is also green, and the one on the extreme east of Africa is also green, so it's a second language in those countries. Now, the great antiquity of the sacred written language, which, of course, Old Arabic was the original version, according to the author of some wonderful books on that topic, Mr. Charles Forster, is my recollection of the gentleman's name who wrote those books about the languages. He wrote books about what are called the Sinaitic inscriptions, right? The inscriptions found in the Sinai Desert, which he attributed to the Israelite people as they were disembarking from Egypt during the Exodus. And he identified that language as Old Arabic, so Arabic language is a very significant one. In the Hebrew, which is speaking about the modern Hebrew, that is, in the Hebrew, the lettering is quite a bit different from the Arabic, but the same exact ideas of the identification of the letters being, you know, consonants and so on, and no vowels represented in the main alphabet. Just it's an abjad, consonantal alphabet without the alpha part. In other words, only consonants. Alpha being a vowel, it can't be called an alphabet. Alpha in the Greek is the letter A, in English, for example, or Aleph in Hebrew. But the great antiquity of the sacred written language may be understood in a number of ways by the reader. As we begin reading chapter 10, paragraph 7, in mention of which fact a warning is advised as to how much of this constitutes, quote, pearls before swine, unquote. With regard to illiteracy and the time required for independent research, as it may fairly be said of writing, that proof in the era of Noah of its alphabet constitutes a sign of an ancienter discipline, so a providence of astronomy in Noah's time is gifted with the necessity of a previous ancient practice. You see, this is like pearls before swine, because nobody is able to prove this one way or the other. I mean, you could say that, writing could have been invented by somebody. It didn't have to have a previous version. And indeed, it must have been originally invented by somebody. It couldn't have always existed. Except, yes, of course it could, because there is someone who has always existed, and that is the Eternal Father, the creator of all things. So we know that language must have always existed, in fact, because where else did the DNA writing come from? The writing of the DNA is a language, and it's something that was created by the true God, the creator of all things, and so who is not the same person as Jesus Christ, by the way. Although Jesus Christ was the one through whom the true God did the creating, so it's, for some people that becomes a stumbling block. But thus astronomy is more ancient also than Noah. 3282 BCE is the date of Noah's deluge. 3282 BCE. What are the factors of that number? I'm curious. What are the factors of 3282? 3282 divided by 2. Oh, look, it's 1641. That's crazy. I don't think I ever tried that before. I mean, it's obvious it's 1641 once you see it, but it's the Hyksos dynasty. That's what one half of the deluge is. The beginning of the Egyptian Hyksos dynasty, which is the Semitic dynasty that came and intervened in the Egyptian government or rulership in the north of Egypt at about 1640 or 1641, which is absolutely a brilliant thing. Another sign of blessing, because it makes everything seem much more organized in our chronology, only in the Blessed Genealogy, not in any other chronology. And there's still a lot of things that aren't quite as perfectly matched or lined up as that in our chronology. But we find in our chronology far more of these types of things than we find in other chronologies. And it wasn't done in order to achieve this. This is not something that we intended. We intended to find the true dates. And this just happened. We're going to talk about that here too, about coincidence and what it means. I see a remarkable circumstance. Of those who believe that chance plays a part in coincidence. You see, chance, if we're talking to the pearls and not the swine, or if we're talking to the non-swine, I should say, and we're presenting this as a pearl, chance plays no part in coincidence whatsoever. He who doubts, to quote the book of James, is like a wave of the sea driven by the wind and blown to and fro. An indecisive man unsteady in all his ways. End quote. We look up the quote at the end here. It's James, chapter 1, verses 6 and 8 of the Good News Translation. If I click on that, it's probably Bible Gateway. Yep, it's Bible Gateway, so it should still be there. Good News Translation. He who doubts is like a wave in the sea that is driven and blown about by the wind. James 1 and 6. James 1 and 8. If you are like that, unable to make up your mind and undecided in all you do, you must not think that you will receive anything from the Lord. And that's true. I don't think that obviously unbelievers are not expecting to receive anything from the Lord because they don't believe in the Lord. But this being undecided in all that you do is what it's like to be a doubter, you know, to be someone who thinks that chance is involved. It's basically the same thing as doubting, because you're doubting the existence of God and his power to make things exactly the way they are. And you need to invoke this idea of chance, which I'm sure is a temptation for imperfect humans. But I was thinking again today, I've thought about it before, but I thought about it with more clarity today about Adam. Adam was never tempted. This idea of the temptation in the garden, that was not a temptation. Because remember, or at least this is a new way of thinking about it that I just thought of today. See, Adam was perfect originally. He was perfect, so he wouldn't have been subject to temptations. So, I mean, imperfect humans are subject to temptation, but Adam was perfect. So, when he chose to eat of the fruit, or of the tree, from which his wife Eve had also eaten, he was choosing with full knowledge. It wasn't temptation. He chose to do it, and that was therefore not based on imperfection, because he was perfect, and it wasn't a temptation. So therefore, there's only one other possibility. It must have been deliberate. He did it deliberately. And that was why that's one aspect of it, let's say. That's all we need to say about that. That's one aspect of it. He couldn't be saved, right? But the other thing is, look, it was a deliberate sin. He couldn't be saved. He'd sinned against the Holy Spirit. But the other thing is, he was perfect at the beginning. And when he sinned, he became imperfect, and all his offspring became imperfect by inheriting that imperfection through the genetic code and all that. They inherited that imperfection. So therefore, what happens is, in order to pay for his sin, somebody else who's perfect has to die to pay for the sin of the imperfect now, Adam, who died as an imperfect man, but that couldn't pay the price of his perfect life. The price of a perfect life is another perfect life. An eye for an eye. An eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth, a life for a life. A perfect man had to die. And Adam was no longer perfect, so his death was meaningless, and there were no other perfect humans after him until Jesus, to die as a perfect man to pay the price of the sin of Adam, which was the sabotage of a perfect life, right, which Adam did deliberately. Now Joseph writes in his Antiquities of the Jews, book 1, chapter 2, number 3, that Seth, the son of Adam, preceded by one generation the invention of the wisdom of heavenly bodies. The invention of the wisdom of heavenly bodies. now, quoting from Josephus, "Now this Seth, when he was brought up and came to those years in which he could discern what was good, became a virtuous man, and he was, as he was himself of an excellent character, so did he leave children behind him who imitated his virtues." He was not a perfect man. That's not what it's saying. According to the Bible, imperfection was lost when Adam sinned. But he could still be a virtuous man. "And as he was himself of an excellent character, so did he leave children behind him who imitated his virtues." "All these proved to be of good dispositions. They also inhabited the same country without dissensions, and in a happy condition, without any misfortunes falling upon them till they died. But death was not the original intention of Jehovah," right? "They also were the inventors of that peculiar sort of wisdom which is concerned with the heavenly bodies and their order. And that their inventions might not be lost before they were sufficiently known, upon Adam's prediction that the world was to be destroyed at one time by the force of fire, and at another time by the violence and quantity of water, they made two pillars, the one of brick, the other of stone. They inscribed their discoveries on them both, that in case the pillar of brick should be destroyed by the flood, the pillar of stone might remain and exhibit those discoveries to mankind. And also informed them that there was another pillar of brick erected by them. Now this remains in the land of Syriad to this day." Now that is a remarkable quotation from Josephus. Unfortunately, the link is broken, but you can find the Antiquities of the Jews by Josephus in many places online. And look up Book 1, Chapter 2, Number 3, and find that passage written by Josephus, which mentions the land of Syria there. The mention of Syria, the passage just cited, is of such considerable interest to the cause of family origins as to occasion further study as the opportunity presents itself. And in passing, I note that Abraham, while living in Haran in Syria, was commanded by Jehovah to go out of that land, his country, that of his relatives, and his father's house. Bad associations spoil useful habits, but so also does one who has intimate association with wise people become wise. References 4, 5, and 6. Isaiah 22 and 13. Was that Bible Hub? Isaiah 22 and 13. Right. It says, "Let us eat and drink, you say, for tomorrow we die." Tomorrow we die. That's the reason why people, that's one reason they give for saying, well, let's live it up and party. Let's use all kinds of different substances and, you know, go nuts because tomorrow we're going to die. That's one of those scriptures that we find there quoted. Well, actually, we didn't quote that one, but that's association. You know, bad association spoil useful habits, that comes from 1 Corinthians 15:33, which says, "Do not be misled. Bad company corrupts good character," in the New International Version. Because, as was quoted in the previous verse, in 1 Corinthians 15:32, Paul wrote, it's not a quote, but Paul quotes from Isaiah. He says, if I fought wild beasts in Ephesus for human motives, what did I gain? If the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. So without the hope of the resurrection, we're all just going to die. So there's no reason why we shouldn't just live it up. go nuts, whatever you want to call it, abuse ourselves, and try and get some pleasure because we're going to die tomorrow. That's the idea that's given in Isaiah that Paul also reiterated in that quote in 1 Corinthians 15, 32 and 33, and Proverbs 13 and 20, walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm. That is the conclusion of today's study of our article, which is chapter 10, paragraph 7 of the Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express, the Ark of Urartu. We might pronounce it that way. The Ark of Urartu, the Orient Express. So this sacred written language, this is the thing that, it's sacred, right? It's called even a sacred secret. Like the message, you know, the idea of the good news and the teaching from the Bible, it's called a sacred secret in the Bible. It's not meant to be taught to just anybody, because, of course, they'll just, in some cases, in many cases, if they don't believe, they'll just laugh and make a mockery of it, and it will do more harm to the one who is teaching than it will to the one who is being taught. And they will reject the teaching, and the teacher will become damaged, you know, by the spiritually damaged by the mockery. So you don't share with just anybody sacred things. You can't, right? You have to be careful. Careful with whom you share things of a spiritual nature. That's the idea. But this sacred written language, this is why it's so fascinating. So to me, it's so fascinating. And perhaps, I don't doubt there are others for whom it is fascinating. The thing is, also, another thing that was said in the Bible is, I think it's in Acts, the very last chapter of Acts. Let's see if we can go there and find it. It's in Acts. I remember this. Paul, the book of Acts was written by Luke, the physician, who followed Paul around. So Paul said, when the Jews who were with him, to whom he was preaching, rejected the message, some began to believe the things said, others would not believe. It says in Acts 28 and 24. But Paul made the comment in verse 25. And he said, he went on in 26 and 27, which is a quote from Isaiah in part. He says, the heart of this people has become unresponsive. If we click on that footnote here, I don't know if we can see it. Look, I can click on Isaiah 6 and 10. Make the heart of this people unreceptive. Make their very ears unresponsive and paste their very eyes together, that they may not see with their eyes, and with their ears they may not hear, and that their own heart may not understand, that they may not actually turn back and get healing for themselves. It's kind of like reverse of what you'd expect. Jehovah's telling Isaiah to make the heart of God's people unreceptive, which is backwards, it sounds like. But it was in order to cause damage until the cities, in verse 11, crash in ruins, to be without an inhabitant. So when people don't believe, the only possible result, or the only possible response by Jehovah, is to destroy them. That's the only possible response he can give. But Jesus talked about pearls before swine and not to cast pearls before swine. But Isaiah, this passage of Isaiah, shows that we don't completely avoid preaching. You know, we still do the preaching. And in some cases, when they reject it, they end up being destroyed. But, I mean, the ones who reject it and never accept it, they have to be destroyed. There's no other possible consequence. I mean, it's obvious, right? But that's the way Jehovah tells us. He tells us that. Therefore, let it be known, Paul wrote in Acts 28 and 28. Verse 28 of chapter 28, he says, therefore, let it be known to you that this, the means by which God saves, which is the good news, it's the good news he's talking about, through the resurrection of Jesus Christ, this, the means by which God saves has been sent out to the nations. They will certainly listen to it. So it's not really of any consequence to us if someone rejects our message, because we know there are people who are going to listen. There are people who are going to believe us. There are people who do believe us. And who will believe us in the future. There are people. Jehovah knows that. He tells us that. And Paul knew that. So, that's some significant reassurance. It's some big way, or it's a big source. That's what it is. It's a big source of comfort for us, source of encouragement that we never have to stop being positive about preaching good things and preaching good habits, for example. Yeah, it amazes me that people think that they can, well, they don't think that necessarily. We don't have to allow them to teach us anything, but they seem to be trying to teach us to follow them in whatever habits people might have, like a person who drinks tends to want other people to drink with, so they want to encourage other people to drink. And a person who uses some kind of vapors or something like that, they want other people to do that with them, and they want to share their bad habits with other people, just in the same way that people with good habits want to share those good habits with other people too. But it's just important to know that we can reject all the bad habits. We can reject them all. And, you know, drugs and all the vapors and all the alcohol, every substance misused, everything that's misused, we can reject all that. Because there are people who are going to want to be with us the way that Jehovah loves us to be, with good habits and wise. The problem with bad habits is they prevent wisdom. And there's another great scripture. I think it's in Psalms 37, I think. That's what I think it is. So let's try and find it. This is really important. So how do you know, right? How do you know that this is true? I'm looking through Psalm 37. That's what I'm doing right now to find this. Still looking. This is talking about the same thing about the that the wicked ones will have to come to their end. They must come to their end. They have to perish. And this is not because we are angry at them, but because Jehovah's angry at them. I think it's at the very end, maybe, of this chapter, is it? Wait a minute. Wow, it's got so much in this Psalm 37. And how he's going to provide escape for the righteous ones from the wicked people, too. It's very encouraging. But there it is. Here it is. Here it is. It's Psalm 37, verse 34. When the wicked ones are cut off, you will see it. In other words, you will understand when the wicked ones are cut off. And that has two different meanings, one of which is Jehovah will destroy the wicked and they'll be gone. Then you'll see it. It's hard to see all of the truth when you're constantly distracted by these wicked forces of the devil and his demons, you know, that are affecting humans and affecting or trying to affect us, you know, distracting us, right? And so the second meaning, though, that when the wicked are cut off means when we stop associating with the wicked ones who are doing these things, when we cut them off and we stop associating with them, when we stop seeing them or talking to them or, you know, having communication or just stop paying attention to them, we will understand. We get understanding then into the true, well, the truth, the sacred secret. We get understanding of the sacred secret at that time when we choose, I mean, voluntarily, you know, deliberately choose to, we voluntarily choose to say we will stop associating with them. So since we can't entirely stop in all communication or all contact with these people, we have to do it as often as we reasonably can, you know, in order to get the insight into the sacred secret. And that's how that goes. It's a wonderful secret. This idea of Syria having it, the writing by Josephus there, and it's saying that the Garden of Eden or Adam was living in the land of Syria sometime at some point, or his family. Remarkable. That's it for today's study. December 25th, 2024 of the Common Era is the date, and the time is 16:45 hours Canadian Eastern Time. I'm Ward Green. Thank you very much for listening and watching. I love you very much. In my behalf, this is Sissy, and this is Star saying bye for now. It was Chapter 10, Paragraph 7, The Ark of Urartu, The Orient Express, Part 2, our continuing study, The Sacred Language. Remarkable, isn't it?